welcome, everybody. This is Mark Reynolds from Citizens Climate Lobby. Welcome to our March International Call, which is now up to 88 groups. Since last month's call, we added two groups in Virginia. We added a group in Birmingham, Alabama, which is really important because we've been developing a relationship with Senator Sessions' office, and to have local people to be able to meet with him, which is great. We added a group in the Upper Peninsula, Traverse City area of Michigan, one in Santa Monica. Santa Barbara started during last month's call, and Santa Cruz is starting as we speak. So I'd like to, first of all, welcome all the brand new groups. Also, for those of you who are new to the call, there's three things we do every month. Every single month, we educate ourselves. So we've had a lot of scientists on the call. We've had a lot of economists. We've had faith-based leaders. We've had military leaders. We've had people whose area of expertise is messaging. So part of what we want to do every month is feel like we have a broader understanding of every component of the issue of climate change, so we have a broader ability to deal with the issue. But then there's two other things we do. Every month we practice speaking about the issue. Oops, Susan, can you find that line and mute it? So that every month we want to feel like not only do we understand the issue better, but we're also better able to communicate it. So we'll have a couple of laser talks that we'll be asking people to practice today so that every single month we feel that we have a greater fluency to deal with the issue. And then the third thing that happens is we ask people to get into action, and hopefully everybody will be able to stay on to hear the kind of results that people produce this month, because you can begin to see the impact of just the constantly getting published in with pieces and op-eds, editorials, letters to the editor, meetings with members of Congress. You can certainly see it in the architecture of the Boxer-Sanders bill. You can certainly see it in the American Enterprise Institute hosting a forum last November on the economics of a carbon tax. You can certainly see it when people like the National Manufacturers Association start to print pieces attacking a carbon tax. It's not just the number of pieces you publish, but because your arguments make sense, that now people are beginning to say, holy cow, this might happen, I better do something about it. So we do those three things every single month, and we'll have specific actions that we ask people to take this month also. Now, I also want to mention we do a spring and a fall fundraiser every year, and we ask people to raise money during the fall because we wanted to add one position to send Danny Richter, who's graduating from Scripps next month, to Washington, D.C. We more than exceeded that total, so when we do the reports from the field, I'm excited to tell you about some of the things that we've accomplished there, because it's significant. We're not going to announce the spring fundraiser as part of this call, but you will be getting letters later in the month of March regarding the spring fundraiser. I want to mention one small piece of this. We got a handwritten note in the mail 2 weeks ago that said this: Dear lobbyists, we want to support your work to implement James Hansen's fee and dividend strategy to reduce greenhouse gases. As we have always lived frugally, we expect you to use your resources prudently. You are our best hope to achieve planet health. It was signed by a couple from Oregon along with a check for $20,000. Now, maybe you're part of an organization that gets tons of checks for $20,000. We're not, so we were pretty happy to get that note and the check. And then I just want to read you the handwritten note that went back to them that day. It said, Dear Mr. and Mrs., I'll leave their name off. Your note and check arrived a few minutes ago. Thank you. Thank you also for your admonition to use our resources prudently. I want you to know that we do and will. I'm the president and founder, and I sign all the checks, and I review all the credit card statements. We have only 3 full-time staff caring for and guiding 88 lobby teams across the nation and growing. About me personally, I'm 74 years old. My mother raised me to be thrifty. I drive a 24-year-old well-cared-for Volvo, and my wife drives a 21-year-old Volvo. I work at Citizens Climate Lobby full-time and take no salary nor expenses. Thank you for the check and note, President Marshall Saunders, president and founder. Every day, there's something that happens like that that just makes me extremely happy to be part of this organization. So I think a lot of times people point to Marshall, the enormous amount of financial generosity that he's had for Citizens Climate Lobby, but it's really the human generosity that is moving to me. Okay, Dr. Staff, there's just one thing I want to tell you about the people who you're speaking to today. Not only are they in action all the time, but they also take the harder view of dealing with the world. It's always easier to say, it's Washington's too hard and there's too much money, et cetera. I want to read you a short note. Our group leaders, so we're organized by chapters in the U.S. and Canada, basically by congressional district in the U.S. and by provincial riding in Canada. And the group leaders are on a call every Tuesday night. One of the new group leaders sent a note after last Tuesday call saying, I'm a serial cynic and always approached situations where action was needed as such, saying, what's the point? It's not like any real change can happen. Hearing someone inadvertently calling me out on my own defeatist attitude is sobering. I've tricked myself into thinking that believing in change can replace acting for change, but I know that is not true. I want you to know you're going to hear a lot more from our group in the future. So Dr. Stout is a climate scientist with the National Wildlife Federation, who uses her expertise to translate complex scientific theories into terms the public can understand. Dr. Stout connects the dots between global warming and weather-related phenomena, including wildfires, hurricanes, increased flooding, and drought in certain areas of the country. Now, the particular area that we were really interested in is the National Climate Assessment. And also, I'm hoping that there's time for questions. If there are today, we'll start in Santa Barbara, then we'll go to Cincinnati, then Lincoln, and then Chicago. And also, I'd just like to say to Lynn Ingram from the World Wildlife Federation, thank you so much for arranging Dr. Stout to be on the call. Thank you for alerting us to where we could support the National Climate Assessment meetings around the country. So, Lynn, we appreciate that very much. And Dr. Stout, we are so happy to have you on the call, and welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here, and it's really inspiring to hear all of you joining in and knowing that there are people out there working hard on this issue all the time, just like we are here at the National Wildlife Federation. Just a little bit about me to give you a sense of where I come from this issue from. I'm a trained in climate science, but now I work for the National Wildlife Federation, where I consider my job to use climate science to catalyze action. And my focus is in sort of four areas, making sure that we have better and more communication about what's happening in terms of climate impacts, working with natural resource managers to help them start thinking about how to use climate science and how they manage wildlife and habitat and our protected areas, working with our legislative team, our policy team, to make sure that the policies that are being discussed and put forward are based on solid science. And then working with our education team to make sure we're getting climate change into K-12 classrooms and college classrooms as well. It's really an exciting place to work at National Wildlife Federation because there are so many opportunities and we're working in a lot of different places in terms of advancing climate science. So I was invited to talk today primarily about the National Climate Assessment. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with it, you may be more familiar with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, which has put out assessments of the impacts of climate change internationally for the last 20-odd years. Well, the National Climate Assessment, or the NCA, I'll sometimes use the abbreviation, the National Climate Assessment is the U.S. version of the IPCC, where U.S. scientists synthesize how climate change is affecting the United States. So over the next little bit, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the history of the National Climate Assessment and how we got to where we are today. I'll talk some about the current process and information, and just so you have a sense of where we are right now, we're working on the third report of this National Climate Assessment. It was released in draft form and on January 14th for a 90-day public review period. So this is a really key window in the process where everybody can have input on the product. And I'll talk to you a bit about how you can engage there. And so that will be the last piece of my prepared remarks will be just a little bit of an overview of the way that different non-governmental organizations are engaging with this National Climate Assessment process and some ideas about how you also can think about engaging. Just to give you a sense of my experience with the National Climate Assessment, before coming to National Wildlife Federation, I worked for the National Academy of Sciences, And a large part of my responsibility there was to work with the scientific community to review how the U.S. government approaches climate change research. And certainly a big part of that is this governmental-led process to assess the climate change impacts in the United States. So I had I was not an insider, but I had a really firsthand window into how the governmental agencies were thinking and working up on climate change, particularly during the early 2000s. For this particular third report, I was an author of one of the technical inputs, and so have had some input in terms of the scholarship, and then I'm very involved in terms of the NGO engagement with the process as well. So let's start with the history. I'm going to go back to 1990, which is when Congress passed the Global Change Research Act, which was then signed into law by President George H.W. Bush. And this act did a couple things. One is it formalized the global change research that was already starting to take place at 13 federal agencies. And it established a global change research program, which is a coalition of these 13 agencies like the National Science Foundation and NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and EPA are big players in this, and DOE is another one, Department of Energy. So it formalized that and sort of provided some structure to the way that the U.S. is going about global change research. And it also mandated that this global change research program produce an assessment of the results of this federally funded research every 4 years, this so-called national climate assessment. And it mandated that this assessment provide information on how climate is changing in the United States and how these changes are impacting the number of sectors, such as health or transportation, biodiversity, water resources, and the like. Shortly after that, they started to kind of organize. It took them perhaps a little longer than we might have hoped, but the first report that came out, the first national climate assessment, was published in 2000. And the process of developing that report included quite a bit of stakeholder engagement, of going out and holding listening sessions and workshops where the scientists and the government researchers directly tried to understand what were the information needs among people who are working in urban infrastructure or transportation or water, or in particular regions of the country like the Northeast or the Midwest or the Southwest, for example. So that's part of the reason it took a long time, because that was sort of a new way of doing scientific assessment, to really try to engage the users of the information at the outset. So that report came out in 2000, just shortly before the election between Al Gore and George W. Bush. Now, the timing, the scientists were not thinking much about the political positioning of this report when it came out. They were just really trying to get this report done. However, the report ended up being highly politicized, this first national climate assessment. Because Al Gore had taken such a strong position on climate change, and he was the vice president at the time, that was considered politically motivated to release this report just a matter of months before the election. And following the election, there were significant efforts among climate change deniers to squash that report and make sure it didn't get out. In fact, they filed a lawsuit demanding that the U.S. government not cite that report or use it in any of its other work subsequently to that. Unfortunately, we were able to push back strongly, and that lawsuit was dropped. And not just the environmental community, but the National Academy of Sciences also was very vocal in saying, first of all, this National Climate Assessment is incredibly scientifically credible, and we devoted a lot of our federal resources to producing it, and it has information that's really relevant to how we manage all sorts of our governmental activities going forward that we should be thinking about. And so because of a lot of pushback, they did not succeed in completely squashing any use of that report. However, during the Bush administration's time from 2000 to 2008, That administration indicated that they would not be pursuing another national climate assessment of the same variety that they did the first time around. And so, of course, that elicited quite a backlash. And so the Bush administration came back and said, okay, we'll do a series of smaller assessment reports, a series of 21 synthesis and assessment reports. And they tried to make the case that that was meeting the requirements of the law, but they did not succeed in making that case, and eventually they agreed to do a single comprehensive report, which was published in 2009, shortly after Obama took office. This second, so we consider that the second National Climate Assessment Report, which came out in July 2009, did not have that same sort of stakeholder engagement and decision-maker input as the first one. And when the Obama administration came into office, they decided that they thought it was valuable and important to return to that earlier model and began ramping up pretty quickly to produce a third national climate assessment that would not only have that stakeholder engagement, but would for the first time meet that deadline of being produced every 4 years as required by the 1990 Global Change Research Act. And so in the last four years, they've done this Global Change Research Program has pursued a very active program of stakeholder engagement. They've held numerous workshops. They commissioned a series of 27 technical input reports on different sectors and regions. So, for example, I was on the steering committee of the one that focused on ecosystems and biodiversity and ecosystem services. They had an open solicitation for anyone to provide technical input and got hundreds of contributions. So they've been working very intensely over the last few years. And on January 14th, they released the draft report for this national climate assessment. Now, it is available online. Anyone can go get it. And I'll give you the website in case you're interested. So that's assessment.globalchange.gov. So assessment.globalchange.gov. I'll warn you that it's more than 1,100 pages. I myself have not yet gotten through all of it yet. It's a very extensive review, which I think speaks to the fact that there is so much information out there and there's so much interest in thinking about how climate change is affecting all parts of our society. Like the previous, the first climate assessment report, it is organized by regions of the country, so you can find detailed information on how climate change is affecting the Northeast, Southeast, Great Plains, et cetera. And then there's also a set of chapters which are organized by sector, so health, transportation, urban infrastructure, et cetera. This time, this third assessment report is the draft, but also for the first time includes chapters on mitigation and what we need to do to slow emissions. And it says very clearly that large reductions are needed to avoid the worst impacts. And in general, this report is much more definitive and strongly worded than the past ones. It starts by saying that climate change is firmly in the present and reiterates many times that we are already seeing climate change today. It emphasizes the types of extreme events that we've been witnessing and how those are already being connected to climate change. So this is actually a very significant change from previous assessments, which were a little bit more tentative in saying that what we're seeing today is part of climate change. This draft report also includes a chapter on adaptation and reviewing what federal, state, and local governments are already doing to proactively prepare for those climate impacts that we cannot avoid. So I encourage you to go look at that or at least look at the summary because it is a little bit overwhelming. And we're right now in the middle of a 90-day public review period, which will end on April 12th. So if you go to the website I mentioned, the assessment.globalchange.gov, you can find a link from there for where you can go and comment on this report. And I encourage you to comment, even if you don't feel like you want to say something about the technical material in there, I think it is important that our government hears that people appreciate and support this sort of process, that it's useful that we are actively thinking about how climate change is affecting our country and what kind of information we need to make better decisions, and that we support the fact that they're coming out and making strong statements about what is happening now. So I think there is value in sending that message to the administration through this particular avenue. And I believe that the denier groups will be submitting significant amounts of comments. So I think it's also important for us to have a counterbalance to that in terms of all the people who really are in favor of getting this kind of information out. And just in terms of how this report process continues, the author group will be collecting all the comments from the public review period, as well as from the National Academy of Sciences review, so a more technical review, and then they will be revising the report. It will go through agency review, and the final version will be is targeted to be released in March 2014. In the meantime, some of those technical reports that were produced as input will also be being released. So just recently, a report on the impact on coastal regions was released, and which actually brings me to the last part of my prepared remarks, which is thinking about how non-governmental organizations have been looking for ways to engage with this national climate assessment process. One of the things that the National Climate Assessment team did was establish a network of NGOs called the National Climate Assessment Network, or NCANet. And at this point, it's over 80 NGOs that regularly participate in conference calls and are looking for opportunities to get the information from this National Climate Assessment out to their constituents and members. So, for example, National Wildlife Federation is featuring this information in our magazine that goes out to millions of people. We're putting it out on our social media channels. We were able to get some articles in the newspapers about it. And we helped co-host a webinar for wildlife managers about it as well. So not just National Wildlife Federation, but lots of other groups are similar looking for ways to get the information that's in this national climate assessment process out to people who are interested and can use it. There have been a series of webinars that have been held. So if you really want to know what's in this report, there have been series of webinars that have been held, and they've been archived, and you can go hear directly from some of the authors. And there's another one that's scheduled for March 14th by the Second Nature and the Security and Sustainability Forum. So I think that's the last sort of big webinar that has yet to be held, but I wanted to mention that in case folks are interested. In addition, that the NCA, along with NGOs, have been holding a series of town halls where they've gathered more than 100 people in a variety of locations to talk about what's in this report and how can we continue to sustain this assessment process going forward. Most of those have already been held. There is one more that's coming up in Portland, Oregon on March 12th. So just thought I'd mention that if there are any folks from Oregon on the call who might be interested. And as well, some of these town halls have been archived, and you can go watch what happened, the presentations that were given there. A lot of this information can be found on the NCANet website, so I'll give you that one too, which is ncanet.usgcrp.gov. And finally, many of the NGOs are thinking about ways to make this 1,000-plus page report and the thousands of pages of scientific research that went into it much more accessible. And I'm just giving one example of what National Wildlife Federation is doing, which is we took the ecosystems piece of this and we translated it into a much shorter, more accessible report with lots of photographs and personal testimonials, and which we released about a month ago. And then we used that report as a way to generate media. So we were able to get a story in USA Today. We were able to work with our field organizers, who we have in 10 different states, to get stories placed in those more state-based and local media. We are now beginning to organize a series of forums where we can continue the dialogue about how climate change is affecting wildlife, which is, of course, an interest of the issue that's of particular interest to National Wildlife Federation. We and other NGOs are looking for similar ways where we can take that material and make it much more relevant and useful for a range of audiences. With that, I think I'll end, and hopefully we've left some enough time to do a few questions.
Great. So let me just, again, thank you so much for that overview, and let me just, I hope you can stay on for the second half of the call to hear how prolific our people are in writing all the time, and they're always looking for new material. So you'll be quoted, you'll hear things from the reports quoted. They will definitely take advantage of this. So let me just, again, repeat the order that we are going to take questions on is we'll start in Santa Barbara, then Cincinnati, then Lincoln, Chicago, just depending upon time if we can get everybody in or not. So first of all, Santa Barbara, if you could star six your phone, that should unmute you, Gary. And just say your name, and I think there's somebody in Santa Barbara that wanted to ask a question. So first of all, just say your name so that you know that I can hear you, okay?
This is Martin from Santa Barbara. Can you hear me?
Sorry, I meant Martin. I don't know why I wrote Gary. Go ahead, Martin. Go ahead, Martin. We could hear you a second ago. To try star six on your phone again, Martin. Are you there, Santa Barbara? Okay, we'll come back to you in a second. Cincinnati, Jeff, I think somebody in Cincinnati had a question. Could you unmute your phone by hitting star six and just make sure that I can hear you?
Okay, this is Jeff. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Jeff.
Okay. So this is really sort of a series of questions around methane emissions and permafrost. But I'm told that methane emissions were pretty flat from 2000 to 2007 and then have spiked after that. I'm told that direct emissions of methane have been categorically ruled out that could account for this increase. The belief is that the source is likely melting permafrost, but there's not yet definitive evidence to point to that. I'm also told that there are three sources of methane in the permafrost: heat, methane hydrate, and I don't recall the third, sorry. Depending on who you ask, there's 2 to 3 times the greenhouse gas emissions in the permafrost total compared to everything man has already put into the atmosphere. So I wanted to see if Dr. Stout could verify any of this and also describe how we will recognize what the tipping point, runaway permafrost melting, will look like. It seems to me we will only know what that tipping point is after we've passed it, and we appear to be already on or over the edge of that tipping point. Thank you.
Jeff, thank you for your question, and thanks for sending an email in advance so I could do a little little research to make sure I had some good information to relay back to you. Methane is something of great concern for National Wildlife Federation, I think for other environmental organizations. The amount of methane that's stored in the permafrost is not just 2 to 3 times more than what's in the atmosphere today. It's more like 10 times more than what's in the atmosphere today. And the amount of methane that's stored underneath the surface of the ocean, on the ocean floor, may be as much as 100 to 2,000 times as much methane as what we have in the atmosphere today. And so there's great concern that if we were to warm up the atmosphere and the Earth's surface and the ocean surface enough, we could start to melt the permafrost and release this methane into the atmosphere. The area of methane research is ongoing. There's an active debate within the scientific community about what's been happening with the sources and sinks over the last decade or so. Jeff, you're right that they were flat for quite a while, for about a decade, and then they've been increasing over the last few years. And there are a number of efforts to try to attribute that to, is it have to do with fossil fuel emissions? Does it have to do with drying up of wetlands? Does it have to do with this melting of the permafrost? And I don't think there's any definitive answer to that yet. I think I wish I could give you a more definitive answer, but it's still just not quite there. And the limitation is partly our observing network. So we have some good observations of methane from space, and we have some good networks around the world, but we need to make sure that they're in the right places to be observing these kinds of emissions that might be coming from these new sources. So hopefully that addresses some of your question, and I wish I could give you a more definitive answer, aside from saying that this is something of great concern, and that if we were to warm enough, that we very well could hit a tipping point.
Yep. Okay, good. Let me just check to see, Santa Barbara, did we get you back, or did we banish you into space? Martin, are you there? Okay, we'll try that in a second.
Martin, can you hear me?
Okay, Martin, go ahead.
Yes, doctor, thank you.
question for you. The information in this report and the report itself, obviously this information will be used by government, by business, sort of by all of government except at the congressional level. And I'm just wondering if you're aware of efforts to make the public aware of the fact that the rest of our society is actually using this information.
Right. So there are sort of a number of answers to that question. Certainly within the federal government structure, there have been, for example, all federal agencies have been required to think about how they are preparing for climate change and what their emissions are and reevaluate their activities along those lines. So a number of federal agencies have recently been releasing their climate action and adaptation plans. So EPA has done that, Fish and Wildlife Service, et cetera. And so there is an active, there's a lot of work right at that federal level to be thinking about it. In terms of the direct engagement with the public, I think there's an interest in that among the National Climate Assessment leadership. I just don't think they have the right kind of capacity to make that happen. And that's why they're often looking to NGOs like myself and NWF and others to be the translators or the folks who are kind of taking that information and making it relevant to those other sorts of audiences. And so I think that's where they are at this point. They just really are kind of working on a shoestring budget, and they can't do direct citizen engagement in the same way that some of our groups that have large memberships are able to do.
Great. Thank you for that. Lincoln, Nebraska, do you have a question there? Could you just make sure we can hear you if you do? Go ahead, Lincoln. You'd have to *6 your phone to unmute it. Don't hit the mute button. Hit *6. Okay, we'll come back to Lincoln in a second. Let's try Chicagoland. Perry, Rick, anybody in the Chicagoland area have a question? And again, you'd have to *6. Go ahead.
Okay, can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so we are wondering whether in the assessment there's something new about extreme weather events that we should be thinking of including in our argument to encourage our Congress members to support legislation on climate change in Congress.
Making connections in the stakeholders, are there any connections with climatologists?
Meteorologists.
Okay. Oh, good questions. And I just want to say hi, Chicagoland. I'm from Chicago, and I love that we're saying Chicagoland.
Don't interrupt the Dr. Stout.
So you may hear me say calendar, in other words, from time to time. Anyway, so this report is actually very, it has a big emphasis on extreme weather events, more so than any past assessment that has been comprehensive like this. And so I think there's absolutely really good information in it, deals with hurricanes and floods and heat waves and wildfires and all those things, and making much stronger connections with climate change. I do happen to know that the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee just held a hearing, so Senator Boxer, on extreme events and climate change a few weeks ago. And so there's definitely an interest there in trying to connect big events like Hurricane Sandy or the big drought and heat waves that we had last summer to the impacts and making sure that we're thinking about what that means for legislation. So connecting with meteorologists, so that has been a really hard nut to crack, and there's been a lot of smart people trying to think about it. So meteorologists are the one scientist that most people have any sort of connection with on a day-to-day basis, and of course they're talking about weather, which is related to climate change. What you need to understand is that meteorologists go through a completely different training than climate scientists. And so they often don't have as strong of a background in climate change. So there are some efforts to try to deal with that problem, continuing education programs organized by the American Meteorological Society, for example, efforts to help provide them prepackaged information that they can use. For example, you know, they might need a 30-second clip about how is climate change connected to extreme heat that they can insert into their broadcast. And you know, the other issue is that much like the general public, there's a spectrum of belief, if you will, about climate change. I don't like using belief because it's facts, and it's not about believing, it's about the facts. But, you know, there's a spectrum of public opinion, if you will, about climate change. And the meteorological community actually sort of maps the same spectrum as the general public. So there's some work to be done in terms of persuading and helping move those people who are in the uncertain or the sort of the middle of that, but more towards the and sort of understanding that this is happening and it's an important issue that they need to address.
Great, great. Well, Dr. Stout, first of all, I hope you can stay on for the next 20 or 25 minutes because I think the kinds of things people are doing will be inspiring, and certainly given how inspiring your talk is, I think it will fit in well. So thank you so much. This has been so useful, so important. We hope we can have you back again sometime also.
I'm excited to stay, and thank you so much for having me.
Great, 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 great. Thank you. Okay, so we want to get to reports from the field, and we're going to start, before we get the general report, I want to start in Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City started this interesting thing where they decided, well, why don't we have a writing group? They get together, and once a week, or I don't know how often, maybe once a month, they get together and they write practice letters or op-eds, and I think it's just a great idea to kind of compare notes. So then this most recent time they got together, they decided to all write on a theme. So first of all, can you unmute your phone, Salt Lake, and is Rob Spicer there?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I'm loud and clear. Go ahead.
Very good. What would you like?
I'd like you to read your letter to the editor, if you don't mind.
Okay. This went into the Salt Lake Tribune about a week ago, and it's called Our Moonshot. In 1961, President John Kennedy astounded the public by vowing to land an American on the moon, quote, before this decade is out. Although the Russians were ahead in the space race at the time, we got there first in less than 9 years. Facing the climate challenge, the Chinese and Germans have invested heavily in wind and solar power. Again, we need to come from behind. Again, our president has called for drastic action. The space race didn't simply get us to the moon. It triggered research, development, and enterprise on many fronts. Our society and economy changed, becoming much stronger. We led the world in scientific and technological innovation. Now we have another very different shot at greatness, to fundamentally reshape the way we get and use energy. To move decisively, we need to phase out fossil fuel as much as possible, rather than dig and drill to get at the last difficult reserves. We also need to see ourselves as we did not long ago, ready to think big, work bold, build new, and thrive.
Great. Thank you so much for such a brilliantly put together letter. I was so inspired when I got it, and it's not just that the very nicely put together letter, but also that you took into account, you know, two calls ago, we had Rob Willer on, who talked about the different views through which liberals and conservatives see this issue and issues in general, and you were able to address the issue from both sides, so I thought that was just fantastic. Thank you so much for that, and thank you, Salt Lake City, for getting together to regularly do the writing together. Obviously, the theme was the moonshot. Okay, good. Amy Bedden, are you there?
Yes, Mark, can you hear me?
I can hear you. So let's just give a little recap of a couple of the key areas. So I know last month we were out of our mind excited because looking at, you know, in 2011 we got 182 letters to the editor published, and then last year we got 535. We liked that more than doubled, and then holy cow, in January we got 108 letters to the editor. How could that possibly happen? That would look at a trend of you know, more than doubling again. So how did we do in February?
Mark, in February, we had 106 letters to the editor.
Okay, that's pretty cool. So then, it's a little bit shorter than January month. Nevertheless, we stayed at that trend of over 100 letters to the editor. And then the other key category then, what about op-eds?
Mark, this is where it's just amazing. We had 40 op-eds in the month of February, 28
okay, so
days.
Okay, so I think 40 op-eds is more than all of 2011 and almost half of what we did in 2012. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay,
and with articles together, you add that with articles, that's 153 total published pieces in February.
Okay, good. So I think everybody remembers we were a little bit out of our mind that we had shattered our record of getting something published last month and we had 142 pieces, and now over 150. It's not the, you know, count that matters. It's that we're actually moving a conversation forward. If 2 years ago or 3 years ago you talked about putting an effective price on carbon, people would tell you you're out of your mind. It's impossible. Now you see the basic architecture of Sanders Boxer being one that you've been talking about for 4 years of fee and dividend. And as I mentioned at the start of the call, you see things like the American Enterprise Institute, who hosts a forum on the economics of a carbon tax, or you see the National Manufacturers Association attacking it, or you see members of Congress writing bills saying it would be illegal to have a carbon tax. So clearly, this would not be happening if you're not only the volume of arguments, but your arguments make sense. I you know, really, to do it justice, we should mention all 40 op-eds, but we can't. But let's just include that one of the op-eds was in the Orange County Register. That's maybe the most conservative county in the entire country. And Salt Lake City, in addition to that letter, in the Deseret News published one of the op-eds. And the Deseret News is the newspaper owned by the Mormon Church. There were a lot of those op-eds that really sent a very simple message out saying that the president said we need to do something and indicated that he would use EPA authority because the Supreme Court had given him EPA authority, and that conservatives, as a contrast, might want to offer a free market approach of a carbon tax, which is what he said in his speeches, is you send me a legislative free market approach or I'll use my authority. And many of those pieces published in places that clearly were not the New York or LA Times sent that message. One of my favorite was from the Wichita Eagle in Kansas City, Kansas, by Rebecca Ryan. In one op-ed, she was able to touch on almost every key piece. She started by talking the president's EPA authority, talked about the importance of a revenue-neutral tax, got in where the consensus is with climate scientists, talked about that we're in a new normal environment, used a line that the real beauty of such a carbon fee is it would not grow the size of government, was able to include that we could put tariffs at the border. Then here's how she concluded. She said, if we act now, we can move ahead of China, Germany, and the other nations currently sitting atop the green economy. We want to lead here, not follow. It is time to demand that Representative Mike Pompeo, Republican Wichita, and Kansas Senators Roberts and Moran take action on the issue. Again, brilliant, because I know we want to get these pieces in front of members after we get published, but if you put their names in the piece, their Google searches, get it to them before we can. She concludes them with two last sentences. New markets and new industries are waiting for us to develop. Let's get busy, get educated, and reach across the aisle to our fellow citizens who want the best for our country. Let's put our heads together and engage the power of all that makes America great to solve this daunting problem. I just give you that as a sample of that's what the op-eds were like. The reason the newspapers are publishing them is as you're sending quality after quality after quality piece out. I also want to thank everybody who participated in the Forward on Climate rallies. So a lot of Citizens Climate Lobby people were at the rally in Washington, D.C. There were a whole bunch of them in San Francisco, also Los Angeles and San Diego. I know that while you can't say Dr. Hansen is a formal part of Citizens Climate Lobby, he might as well be. In the speeches that he gave in the last week in Santa Fe and Claremont, there were a lot of Citizens Climate Lobby people there. He gave big shout-outs. And I just want you to know on that Wednesday night introductory call, a lot of people have been coming to those introductory calls because of the people that you've been directing there, from all of you who were there freezing your butts off in Washington, D.C., or supporting the events in other places around the country. Also, Tamara in Portland, could you unmute your phone for just a second? Portland? Star 6 Portland?
Hi, Mark.
Hi,
can
Tamara.
You hear me?
Yeah, so on your regional, on your regional call the other day, you were talking about the impact of having Caitlin go to the national conference last year. And would you mind sharing that with everybody?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I remember when Caitlin came back from that conference, and previous to going to that conference, Caitlin was an average college student with a passion to do something for the environment. And when she came back, the words that came out of her mouth and the comfort with which she was speaking and addressing the carbon tax and all the meetings that she had had with all these members of Congress, it was amazing. It was incredibly inspiring, incredibly just intelligent the way that she was speaking about it. It made me really, first of all, really excited for our group that we had this co-leader at our helm who could really teach us about it and also just provide this level of inspiration that we hadn't had up until that point. And then it also, on a personal level, made me really, really want that. So we're hoping, fingers crossed, that the three of us can get to, four of us, in fact, four group members can get to D.C. this year. We're really excited to make that happen.
Great. Thank you. And we're, by saying this, Tamara, we are not endorsing Caitlin's method of transportation. Let's say that while we do love that Caitlin did not get an airplane to lower her carbon footprint, we are not endorsing 21-year-old women hitchhiking from Portland to Washington, D.C. for the conference. So let's be clear, we are not saying that that is one of our preferred methods of transportation for the conference this year. Tamara, thank you so much for that. And then let me just say something. There are some groups that are trying to raise money to support the conference in general, and if you have a 200-word or less statement about your experience at the conference, if you would get that to me, that will help some people who are actually trying to be out there looking for testimonials about the international conference. So if you get a chance to get that to me, that would be fantastic. Okay, Steve Volk, can you read the two U.S. actions and then the U.S. laser talk, and then Kathy, I'd like you to read the Canadian actions, and then I have a couple of other things I want to get to after that today.
Mark, can you hear me?
I can.
Great. Okay, so the two actions for the U.S. this month. First is to write letters to your two senators asking them to improve and co-sponsor the Climate Protection Act and plan your group strategy for generating additional support in your state for that legislation. And then the second action for U.S. groups is to confirm with to confirm which members of Congress your group will research and schedule meetings with during the conference in Washington this summer, and to make sure that you send your list to Amy Bennett. So would you like to hear the laser talk right now?
Please, yeah.
Okay, great. So the laser talk for this month supports our letter writing action for our senators. Is President Obama has asked Congress to address climate change, saying, if Congress won't act soon to protect future generations, I will. The good news is that Congress is beginning to stir. Senators Barbara Boxer and Bernie Sanders have announced the introduction of the Climate Protection Act, S-332, which places a tax on carbon-based fuels and returns much of the revenue to households. And this is a simple, straightforward, and effective approach that uses the power of the free market to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And by giving revenue back to households, it shields consumers from the economic impact of higher energy costs associated with the carbon tax. While this is a good bill, there are two things that could make it better. First, make it revenue neutral, meaning that all of the revenue would be returned to households. Republicans would be more likely to co-sponsor a revenue neutral bill. Also, the tax must ramp up more aggressively, at least by $10 a ton each year, in order to achieve the reductions in CO2 needed to avert disaster. Senator, will you co-sponsor the Climate Protection Act and write to Senator Boxer or Senator Sanders to suggest that these changes to improve and ensure its passage?
Great. Crystal clear, Steve. And then just so everybody knows, we promised that every month between now and the conference, we would add a bonus talk so that we had as many talks that you had chance to practice on between now and the conference. The additional one is about Mark Jacobson and Mark DeLucci's paper about how we could convert all of the world's electricity to renewable energy in 20 years. We understand that that would take a worldwide two-like ramp-up, but it's important to know that there's a plan, there's an approach actually to convert the world's renewable energy with no additional cost. Steve, thank you so much. Let me just say, then, Kathy, I'm going to have you read the actions in a second. So Steve said we're asking people to write your senators, but to write your senators against the background of what is your plan to make sure that your senators sign on as co-sponsors. So now, if you ask that question, you might say, well, you never asked me to come up with a plan. Well, now I am. So if your group already doesn't have a plan, say in, you know, somewhere in California or Tennessee or Maine, that we're not just asking you to take an action. The action is one event inside of your group doing the work to make sure that your senators come on and sign on support of the bill. The second piece is doing research on the members of Congress. We want to know at the end of today which congressional offices and which members of the House and the Senate you're going to do the research on, so we know which ones the interns have to take on. Now, we're going to research carefully every single member of Congress, and the way we would like you to approach this is that every single one that gets researched is the only one that needs to get researched, that we do it thoroughly and completely, and what we want to get back today is which ones are you taking on, so we know that which ones the interns have to take on so that we can get to the entire House and Senate in June. Okay, Kathy, could you read the Canadian actions, please?
Certainly. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Kat.
Wonderful. And I just want to say, I want to preface this by saying we sure wish that Canada would take the lead on climate change, and please forgive the Keystone XL pipeline thing that's happening. But it's no accident that Canada is partnering with CCL USA on our actions this month, and that's reflected in our actions. So our actions this month are write letters to your MPs informing them about the USA's Climate Protection Act, and use the laser talk and the monthly action as a guideline, including support materials and suggested improvements to the Climate Protection Act, as was in the USA. But also, write this letter in context that March is federal budget month in Canada, and that Canada has consistently aligned its climate policies with the USA since 2006. As well as being done in the USA, keep in mind your group's strategy for generating support for carbon fee and dividend in your writing. And if you haven't started doing that, it's a good idea to start now, because our second action of the month is on Tuesday, March 12th at 8 p.m. We will be having a strategy call just for Canadians, and we will share our various strategies on how we are working with our MPs and in our ridings. We have four different political parties in Canada, plus all the regions. We will share an outline of our two-year strategic plan developed by CCLers on this call. And there's a series of ongoing actions. I won't go into detail. And I have a special request that was added on since Tuesday. Please take 2 minutes and nominate Marshall Saunders, the president and founder of Citizen Climate Lobby, for the Guardian newspapers, that's a BC, United Kingdom, the Guardian newspapers, climate abolitionist fighting for a sustainable world. Thank you.
Great, Kathy. Thank you. And a really strong month by Canada. Of the 106 letters that were published, 15 were for Canada, so way more than as a percentage of chapters. Canada was really, really strong. Okay, a couple last things that I think are important. One is, I mentioned that in March we'll be sending our spring fundraising letter out again. What we asked you to do in the fall was to raise enough money to add a legislative and policy analyst in Washington, D.C., and I think everybody knew that we were we had planned on hiring Danny Richter as soon as he finished his Ph.D. at Scripps. He's defending his Ph.D. next Friday, and according to Nate Silver's blog, he has a 98.6% chance of passing, and given he predicted the Electoral College, we feel good about Danny. So anyway, we will have Danny in April in D.C., so we're excited about that. But also we were able to raise enough money to add two project managers. So Lene Pettengill has already come on and made a huge impact in adding new groups. Madeline Pera is going to be coming on in June after she finishes the school year. This has created an enormous bonus to the staff, and that the workload that three people have been doing over 4 years, no matter how much we changed in size, has been expanding. We just have a couple of things that we have to add to get our first level of staffing done. What we think that then allows us to do is to go to foundations and say, okay, we've stabilized our staffing position. We have everybody we need. If you can add a little money, if we can get 8 regional coordinators, we'll have a group in every single congressional district in the U.S. and every riding in Canada. So we think that having phase one essentially in place allows us to go to foundations and say, if you fund phase two, every congressional district, every riding would be having support back home. Okay, then here's the last, two last things. One is the first step, so those of you who have been to a Group START workshop at Citizens Climate Lobby know that we have a 10-step process for planning an effective meeting with a member of Congress or Parliament. The first step is research. The second step, and so that's what we've been talking about, is doing the research. There's a lot of resources in the form for doing research for members of Congress that are with the action sheet. So it can include their faith, it can include their committees, it can include statements they've made, it can include if they've walked away from their Grover Norquist pledge, which we're seeing more and more of. So the first step is to do as much research as we can to have the greatest possible chance of success. But then the second step is what people usually wouldn't expect, and that is to schedule follow-up. Why are we asking you to put information in your calendar that says after you have a meeting that you do follow-up? Well, it's because we want to be the kind of organization that when we say we're going to do something, we do it. See, I think many of the people are in my age group in this call, and that is we grew up in a time where there wasn't enough information. So we've thought that if we just got people enough information, they'd do the right thing. But if you look at our country, everybody in our country has the information about diet and exercise, but look at the reality of our country. So we do not go into those meetings with members of Congress with 16 reports thinking if they just read these reports, they will have what they need to do the right thing. Rather, what we do is we sit down with them. And then if they say information would be useful to them, we'll make sure and get them the information. So part of that process then is first of all, we do the research, but then the second piece is we schedule follow-up. Because I suggest that way more important than information in our relationship with working with people is trust. And part of how you develop trust is when you say you'll get something to somebody, you do it. So if we can get in establish the habit that when we're going to prepare for a meeting, part of the preparation for that meeting is to schedule the follow-up. So that when we say that we'll get them something, whether it's paper or electronic or a phone call, we actually do it. Okay, we'll be talking about more in the conference between now and June. Okay, the very last thing. So Jim Thrall is our group leader in Anchorage, Alaska. He started the group about 3 years ago. And he's going to be moving to Illinois so to be closer to his grandchildren. So he has done an amazing job of stewarding our group there, and Alaska is Anchorage, and Alaska is such an important state. So we're happy that Jim can be closer to his grandchildren, but we're also happy that George has stepped up to take over the group. So usually we just say goodbye at the end of this call, but at the end of today's call, I'd like everybody to just shout a biggest shout-out to Jim for thanking him for getting Alaska started. I don't think we get where we need to get to without support in Alaska because of what's happening there and their congressional delegation. So I'm going to unmute everybody's line as you sign off today. If you could just say thank you, Jim, that would be really, really great. Appreciated by me, appreciated by the Alaska chapter. So bear with me 1 second.
All guests have been unmuted.
California, yoo-hoo!
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, welcome to Illinois.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Jim. We love you, Jim.
We love you.
guy. I think he had a beard.
Susan, go ahead and just cut the line off, okay?
Will do. Thanks.
Thank you, sweetie.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay, bye-bye. Thanks a lot. Thanks, Jim. Thank you, Dr. Stout, if you're still on.
Jim, take me a sec.
Thank you for calling.